This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Sunday, March 31st, 2024. I'm Jared Halpern. President Biden brings in a record campaign haul with some help from a couple of predecessors.
There's an organizational advantage, I think, with the Biden operation. There's certainly a financial advantage.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Lawmakers' growing concern with China and the communist country's increasing holdings of U.S. agricultural land is leading to some bipartisan agreement about tracking and possibly denying future purchases.
When we look toward the future, when we may have more tense moments with China, the last thing we want is to give them the kind of control over our food supply that Europe allowed Russia to have over their energy supply.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Three for the price of one. Not a bad deal, even if it costs you tens of thousands of dollars. But Democrats who could spend between $225 to as much as $500,000 were able to see President Biden on stage with his two Democratic predecessors, former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, in a conversation moderated by late-night host Stephen Colbert at New York's famed Radio City Music Hall. In all, the event raised more than $26 million for the Biden-Harris campaign, considered the most successful single political fundraiser in American history. The massive single-night fundraising haul also widens what is a significant advantage the Biden campaign has over the Trump campaign in not only money coming in, but cash on hand, a metric used to measure the strength and sustainability of campaigns. The Trump campaign is criticizing the glitzy fundraiser the same day that former President Trump spent time on Long Island at the wake of slain New York Police Department officer Jonathan Diller, who was murdered Monday during a traffic stop.
This should never happen. I just visited with a very beautiful wife that now doesn't have her husband. Stephanie was just incredible. Their child, brand new, beautiful baby, sitting there, innocent as can be, doesn't know how his life has been changed. But the Diller family will, you'll never be the same. You can never be the same. And we have to stop it. We have to stop it. We have to get back to law and order. We have to do a lot of things differently, because this is not working. This is happening too often.
Fox News Radio political analyst Josh Krossauer also says bringing in big names like former President Obama speaks to a strategy for the current president to keep core constituencies engaged.
Look, if he wasn't raising $25 million from an event like that, once really a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime type event, it would not be a good look for the Finance Committee on the Biden campaign. Jared, it reflects the advantage that the Biden campaign does have on the fundraising front. We're already seeing with the latest reports, the Biden campaign has stockpiled quite a bit more money than the Trump campaign, that some of the outside groups backing Trump have had to spend money on legal expenses as Trump's legal problems continue on and will continue through the election. And I'm not a believer that money is more important than message and just the general political mood of the country. Ultimately, you need to have enough money to run a good campaign. But just because one campaign has a little more money is probably not going to make the difference in a presidential campaign like this. But it certainly is going to give Biden an opportunity to go up on air early, to define the stakes, to really be more aggressive, perhaps, than he otherwise would be if he didn't have the same amount of financial advantage that he does at this early stage.
And it also, I assume, allows a much larger kind of infrastructure to be built out much sooner in a lot of these swing states we've spent a lot of time talking about.
Well, look, we heard this week that the Trump campaign feels like they're behind organizationally in Michigan, which is the state that Biden is, you know, struggling with.
I mean, that may become the state that we're looking at, you know, on election night. I mean, it could all come down to Michigan.
Right. I mean, money finances ads, but also finances ground game. And look, it's kind of notable that a state where Trump seemed to be doing pretty well in, he hasn't matched the infrastructure. The money hasn't yet poured in from the RNC, from the campaign, from all the other state party apparatus, you know, the state party apparatus as well there, which has also been under quite a bit of turmoil. So there's an organizational advantage, I think, with the Biden operation. There's certainly a financial advantage. The mood of the country is very fickle. The people want change. They're not satisfied with the direction of the country. And that can ultimately be more impactful when it comes down to an election than money and infrastructure.
I guess what I'm curious about is, you know, it's obviously President Obama, former President Obama, still has a lot of pull, still has a lot of influence with the Democratic Party. He was obviously very young when he was elected. He is not sitting this out. I think historically, traditionally, former presidents sit out at least most of the campaign. Sometimes you see him come in as a closer. Obama's getting in this in March, man. That to me signals, I don't know if it signals worry, but certainly the Biden folks must feel like they need a little bit of help here, maybe with younger voters, with more progressive Democrats.
Well, look, I was fascinated. First of all, I thought Obama gave quite the speech at the fundraiser last night. He notably, not only is he coming in early, which is significant because he understands the stakes and he understands that Biden needs every little bit of help he can get, especially from surrogates. And especially, you know, Biden has stepped up his campaign travel in recent weeks, but I think there's some worry that he may not, you know, have the same pace as other presidential candidates have. Trump, but for what it's worth, has not had a very aggressive campaign schedule either. So the one thing that was notable from Obama's speech, though, Jared, is there were some protesters, anti-Israel protesters at this fundraiser, and Obama spoke directly to them at this event and basically kind of called them out for their kind of absolutism in their politics and how compromise is part of the political game. And Obama is very popular with younger, was popular when he was president, certainly with younger voters. He has been worried about he's spoken out about you know, what's commonly known as these woke trends on campuses and on the left. And he could really be, Biden has had trouble dealing with the far left. And Obama, you know, not just by being someone who can bring them on board, but also calling them out when necessary and doing it in a way that, you know, I think he has a lot more credibility to do that than Biden does and other people in the Biden orbit do. And I thought last night, the fundraiser this week was a good example of how Obama could be used in that effect to call out some of the more extreme elements of the left.
Do you expect to see, I expect to see Obama quite a bit now between now and November. What role do you think he plays now moving forward? Is it just like these glitzy kind of one-off fundraisers, or is he kind of, you know, on college campuses? Is he in the swing states? I mean, does he want to play and does he want to get back on the campaign trail? I would think former presidents kind of have the luxury of being able to kind of just have a pretty good life there of their choosing.
Well, to the point earlier, I think Obama did so many campaign appearances as president, and they didn't work out very well. He helped himself, but he didn't elect a lot of other Democrats down ballot. That was never showed. Never was as successful a surrogate as I think he hoped he would be. But I actually, to the point earlier, I think he could go to college campuses and kind of give a tough love message, supporting the Biden ticket, but talking about some of the themes he brought up last night. These are the voters that the part of the Democratic coalition, the more progressive elements of the coalition, younger voters, African-American voters, certainly, by the way, like there are a lot of polls suggesting excitement, enthusiasm, engagement among Biden's most reliable supporters in 2020 is way down. Obama can help on that front. So I think he can tailor a message to certain communities, to certain constituencies that Biden really needs. And so I don't think he wants to send Obama all over the country to all the swing states. I think there's going to be a much more, or there's certainly, it's in Biden's advantage for Obama to have a much more targeted message and to some particular constituencies that have been reluctant to embrace Joe Biden's reelection.
What about Bill Clinton? He's been active in his post-presidency years. I don't know if it seems to me that his kind of Democratic base is probably very similar to Biden's, right?
Yeah, look, I mean, Clinton is no longer the kind of surrogate. In fact, he wasn't used a whole lot in 2020. I mean, he is the the big dog, but he doesn't have the same cachet. You know, it's been, God, so hard to believe it's been 32 years.
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to say it. Yeah.
I mean, that makes me feel old
just thinking about it.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of people that don't even remember, like, at all Bill Clinton's presidency. So, and he also has a lot of, you know, there's controversies that would be brought up if he does a lot of activity for Biden. So I don't see Bill Clinton playing quite that.
Not, certainly not in the role that you think Obama could really play here over the next several months.
Correct. Obama is a much more effective surrogate if he, you know, if used properly. Clinton, I think, is sort of more of a fundraiser, someone who's better utilized at fundraisers.
Do these events also contrast at all any kind of unity deficit for either party? Obviously, we've talked about Obama kind of being used to maybe bring in some of the constituencies that are softening on Biden. I don't think we're going to see Donald Trump do anything with like George W. Bush, right?
Oh, no. I mean, look, Jared, think about it. Every living Republican president, and I believe like vice president and vice presidential nominee, with the exception of Sarah Palin, I don't think they're endorsing Donald Trump. You know, it's kind of remarkable. Mike Pence, right? Yeah. Not endorsing Donald Trump.
Who was his vice president?
Mitt Romney. Let's add the nominees to the mix. Yeah. I mean, it is stunning when you think about it, the degree to which the Trump Republican Party looks absolutely nothing like the Republican Party that was so dominant for decades, including as recently as 2016, right? So it is a different cast of characters, and I don't think you will see many big events like you saw in New York this week for Joe Biden. On the other hand, you are seeing Republican donors, including a lot of folks who are not very friendly to Trump, who mm-hmm. were resistant to Trump and didn't want to give money and supported some of his rivals. You're seeing some indicators that many of those donors are actually getting back on board. And mm-hmm. these are big donors that Trump badly needs to write big checks for his outside groups and for you know, to help get people in their networks to support his reelection. So that is happening. You are seeing Trump events, but not big name politicians, more big name donors that had drifted away from Trump in recent years.
Does that kind of throw cold water on? I know that there was like this, a lot of talk, you know, after the primaries and after Nikki Haley dropped out, that, you know, where are these Haley voters going to go? They're not, are they going to go to Trump? Are they going to sit out, or are they going to become Biden voters? I mean, the idea that a lot of these, as you point out, kind of more, I guess, establishment Republican donors are coming into the Trump campaign. Does that throw cold water on a lot of that rhetoric that, you know, these are these Haley voters are never going to come into the fold?
Yeah, I'm actually surprised that neither a nominee is really going after the Haley voters. I mean, I think his message is more resonant in some ways to you know, worrying about what happened on January 6th and, you know, the impact to democracy and what would happen to our democracy if he won a second term. Like those are questions that overlap with the Liz Cheney wing, the Mitt Romney side of the party, and Joe Biden's reelection campaign. That said, like, you're not seeing, you know, Joe Biden really make any moves to court the Nikki Haley faction in the Republican Party. He's not, if anything, he's getting a little more wary, for example, of like Israel's you know, invasion of and fight against Hamas, which is something that is a big priority for folks like Haley. Foreign policy, you know, hawkishness and internationalism mm-hmm. is a big focus for that wing of the party. And you're not seeing Biden really do much outreach in that respect.
Well, let's talk about that to end this conversation, because obviously, you know, you talked about Michigan, kind of the build out that both campaigns want to have. I mean, this is going to come down to a handful of states, right? We've talked about Michigan, obviously Wisconsin's on that list, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, right? I think I've hit them all. Maybe I've missed a couple. In a state like Georgia or Arizona that was decided by several thousand votes 4 years ago, that number of Haley voters or that number of disaffected progressive voters could be determinative, right? I mean, at what point do you kind of see an all hands on deck from both campaigns to see what they can do to either win those voters over or prevent them from voting third party? Right. Is there going to be a gang up on, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? Is there going to be a gang up on Cornel West or any of these other candidates?
So on the just about the Haley voters or the anti-Trump Republicans, you know, the Biden campaign is trying to do two things at once. They're trying to keep their, we just talked about how they have problems on their left flank with progressives, with young voters, with African-American voters. So I think they're struggling to figure out how do we get some of the left-wing voters that have been disenchanted with Biden while also getting the centrist voters and even folks on the center-right who also would like to support Biden but want to see more policy from him in their wheelhouse. So that's the challenge, and they're trying to, I think, pander and trying to have it both ways, but it's been hard to kind of get a sense of how they kind of accomplish both goals, especially as we get closer to November. You know, look, as far as states go, Jared, I think it's going to come down to just three states, to be honest. I think it's going to come down to Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. There's signs that Georgia is getting out of reach for the Biden campaign. There's no big statewide election other than the presidential race that's going to drive Democratic turnout, like we saw in the last two seasons where you had a huge Senate campaign and a huge governor's race. Mm-hmm. So I think Georgia is actually looking more Republican. Arizona, I think, is going to be tough as well for the Democratic Party, but we'll see. But I think it's going to come down to the big three blue wall states, used to be called the blue wall states.
Right.
Midwest. Yeah. Those are states where you have a working class, a wider wider electorate, a working class kind of background with a lot of voters. And polls show those races are neck and neck. I mean, there was a poll out from Bloomberg this week showing literally a tie in Michigan and Pennsylvania. And I think it was maybe a 1-point lead for Biden in Pennsylvania and a tie in Michigan.
Certainly within the margins. We're talking about
within margins. The margin of error.
We're talking about right. margins.
But they, as Dan Rather would say, tight as a tick in all three of those states, right? So those are the three states I'm watching most closely. Not that Nevada isn't going to be a battleground, not that Arizona isn't going to be a battleground, but I think it's going to come down to the big three prizes in the Midwest and in Pennsylvania.
Well, those were the three states that made so much difference in both 2016 and 2020, right? So it would be, on script for those to be the three big states that we watch here in this rematch between Biden and Trump. I guess I'll finish with this, and that is, you talked about both the pace of campaigning here, the cadence of the campaigning. It is a different kind of era. Do you need these big kind of rallies so much anymore, or do you expect to see? I mean, obviously, 2020 was a bit of an outlier with COVID, but I mean, I don't know. Are we seeing a change in the way that candidates kind of run for national office, given social media and news coverage and television and internet and digital advertising?
Yeah, I mean, look, the way candidates get their message out it has been changing, and it's going to change even more as we get into the 2024 election season. They're different sort of niches. They're different little echo chambers that candidates have to reach out to find young voters. Young voters aren't reading the New York Times. They're not watching cable news, right?
Yeah.
They are on social media platforms that a lot of people that are a little older don't use. So, like, the old model of just airing a lot of campaign ads, or even a more recent model of going on YouTube and having a few viral clips on Twitter, that's no longer gonna be enough to reach out every constituency that these candidates need to reach out to. The Trump folks, there are a lot of people in their coalition that are very disillusioned and don't really trust mainstream media or anything that they see in media. And then you have a lot of younger Biden folks that are just using different technologies that a lot of frankly more traditional media outlets are not familiar with, right? TikTok might be banned, right? TikTok could be regulated out of existence if things go the way that certain law,
For the time being, the Biden campaign is on TikTok. We will see if anybody's on TikTok in the months ahead.
And not to digress, but that shows how complicated this is to reach new voters, right? Because they're using platforms that are, and then at the same time, leading legislators are looking to regulate them.
Well, and the administration has warned about. So
exactly, yeah, it makes your head spin. The Biden campaign, you said, Biden campaign's on TikTok, but they're now supportive of legislation that could lead to the ban of TikTok. So it makes your head spin, and it shows how volatile the media environment is, and how things have changed so much since the last election.
Well, it certainly does show, I think, as well, how important, it sounds cliche, but every vote matters, and reaching these voters is going to matter a great deal, especially in those three states that you point out, where we have seen the margins of victory for both Trump and Biden over the last two elections be just so slim. And, it's not going to take a huge number of voters sitting out or voting, you know, unexpectedly that maybe change an outcome. So it'll be fascinating to see how those strategies play out over the next several months. Obviously, the Biden campaign is going to have a lot of money to throw at this. We'll see what role that plays as well. Josh Krossauer, always appreciate the time and the insights. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Jared.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Food security has become national security. That was the theme of a recent congressional hearing called The Danger China Poses to American Agriculture.
They are buying up our entire food supply chain, and when America can't feed itself and we rely on other members of another country to feed us, it becomes a national security issue. The country that feeds us will control us.
Kristi Noem, who's worked in farming herself, is South Dakota's governor, and she told the House Committee on Agriculture.
They have decades ago started buying our fertilizer companies, controlling our ability to access fertilizer, bring it into the United States. Then I watched them buy up our chemical companies as I worked on implementation of programs and policies at our state level and at the federal level. I watched us as we sold citizenship to Chinese communist members of the Communist Party for investment into our processing systems, and now most of our processing facilities are owned by the Communist Party or Chinese government. Now they are coming for our land.
Noem said between 2010 and 2020, Chinese land holdings increased by over 5,300%, and that the Chinese now own 384,000 acres of American agricultural land. At a later point in the hearing, Nova Daly testified. He's a public policy consultant now, but he used to work at Treasury, where he directed the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. CFIUS, as this committee is known, analyzes and reviews foreign agricultural land purchases near American military bases. He said there's been a number of Chinese acquisitions near military facilities.
A number of transactions occurred in Nevada that were, you know, under the label of a gold mine that actually was meant to observe our nuclear facilities and capabilities, as well as our, in Oregon, a Rawls transaction involving a wind farm. Devices could be put in there to see what we were doing. And the facility they were looking at, the Windbee, that would have given sight to, I mean, that was a critical facility to the United States in terms of what we're doing in defense of Taiwan.
Now, the Government Accountability Office released a report this year that notes there is a law on the books called Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act of 1978, but that better, more detailed information needs to be collected for it about foreign land purchases, noting that the Committee on Foreign Investment does not review most foreign land purchases.
I mean, in general, foreign investment is a good thing, right? If Toyota wants to build a new car factory in Tennessee and create great American jobs, that's a good thing. That makes America stronger.
South Dakota Republican Congressman Dusty Johnson.
But my interest in foreign investment gets real thin in a hurry when we're talking about our adversaries. And that's what we're dealing with the Chinese Communist Party. We know that they are trying to gain coercive economic power over the global food supply. And they've said that. I mean, they've made that clear. Their ownership of farmland outside of China has increased 1,000% in the last 10 years. And when we look toward the future, when we may have more tense moments with China, the last thing we want is to give them the kind of control over our food supply that Europe allowed Russia to have over their energy supply. That's why I think it's important we draw a hard line now.
That's an interesting comparison. So this got, I mean, this is getting renewed attention right after the ag hearing that happened last week. I'm wondering, what do you think there is the will to do here? Because we saw the House ban TikTok, right? What are we talking about in terms of Chinese or any adversarial country's land holdings in the U.S. as far as, I guess, something that has teeth or something moving forward that changes regarding who gets to hold our land?
For 30 years, our country was mostly sleepwalking through this threat from the Chinese Communist Party. But we are waking up, and we're waking up in a bipartisan way. And that's why I think the TikTok divestiture passed so overwhelmingly. People understand that this is not just a cute social media app. This is Chinese Communist Party malware. And similarly, I do think there's a strong will to prohibit the Chinese Communist Party and their partners from buying American farmland and probably also American agricultural processing facilities. I would be surprised and disappointed if by the end of the year, we haven't come together, Republicans and Democrats, House and Senate, to get that done.
So, Congressman, just to put a finer point on how all of this works, so we educate ourselves and our listeners. There is a Foreign Investment Disclosure Act right now that requires reporting of foreign purchases of ag land to the USDA. But we learned this at the ag hearing, right? It's this slow, cumbersome process. It's not detailed. It paints an incomplete picture. So we really don't know, even right now, who owns all of our land.
Yes, there is already a process. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., sometimes called CFIUS, does have to review and actually approve major foreign investments in our country. And normally they say yes, because again, normally foreign investment makes our country stronger. There's never been a voice focused on food or agriculture on CFIUS, though. And that's one of the things I've been pushing most strongly for the past 2 years. I think we need somebody who calls out the critical importance of food supply. You know, when you look at things you absolutely have to have as a country when times get tough, I mean, you really do want to have control over your own medicine, your own pharmaceuticals. You want control over at least some of your own manufacturing capacity, and you need control over your own food. Food security is national security. And unfortunately, in all three of those areas, pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, and food, we have given the Chinese Communist Party too much control over our country. And I've been pushing for some strong CFIUS reforms that would better focus that body on the importance of not allowing the Chinese to take over control or even influence over our food supply.
Oh, pharmaceuticals, that's a huge one. We'll have another interview about that. But Governor Noem floated this idea of a state-level CFIUS board, right? At the federal level, a CFIUS board within the Treasury Department examines, as you said, foreign investment in the U.S. She wants that to apply to all land purchases in her and your state. That failed, but South Dakota now has some new restrictions or teeth to an existing law. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, this has been something that the South Dakota State Legislature has been wrestling with for the last couple of years. And Governor Noem's a strong leader, and you know she would be able to make a lot of things work at the state level that other states would struggle with. Fundamentally, though, I mean, I think this is a national issue. I mean, I think when you look at what is the appropriate constitutional division of labor, what should states do most? I mean, a lot more than they do, right? The federal government does too much. We really should leave a lot of that leadership to the states. But when we talk about foreign adversaries, that is something that, while it's great to have state leadership, and I applaud the governor, and that's why I pushed so much to have her come testify before the Ag Committee, We can't just have a federal government that puts its head in the sand and assumes that the states will take care of it. The federal government, CFIUS, has access to data the states don't. CFIUS has access to expertise that the states don't. And so state leadership is a good thing, but it is no substitute for us, Congress, getting our act together as well.
Well, and CFIUS, like at the federal level, if the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., CFIUS, wants to, they can, you know, intersect with intelligence agencies, right, to a certain degree. I mean, that's part of the process of figuring out if this foreign entity can and should get to invest in our country. So when you say that there's bipartisan will on this and that this aspect of this might be best done federal government, is there a push now for, I guess, extensive or expanded CFIUS review of future land holdings?
Yes, we're going to get this done. I have every confidence. And we've done this sort of thing in the past. Many people probably remember how dependent our telecommunications infrastructure was on Huawei, a Chinese manufacturer that had deep ties to the Chinese Communist Party. And then our country woke up. I mean, the experts reminded us. We got intelligence briefings about how much liability and exposure we had because all of our telecom infrastructure was running on Huawei equipment. And so we undertook a major national initiative to rip and replace, get all of that Huawei material out and replace it with things that didn't open up the door to that kind of malign CCP influence. We can do that same thing when it comes to technology being used at our ports and when it comes to who's controlling our food supply.
Congressman, what is here already? We heard from one of those witnesses who used to work at Treasury during the Bush administration. He was saying that there's what, like Chinese ability to spy from wind turbines. And in Nevada, there was Chinese ability to spy on some of our nuclear facilities. What do you suspect is already here in our country?
It is sometimes the more fantastical stories like a Chinese spy balloon or their purchases of farmland near a military base that capture the public imagination. But those are, in many respects, almost insignificant pieces of the massive surveillance apparatus that the Chinese Communist Party has erected. I mean, probably the most effective tool they have to spy on Americans is TikTok, which 170 million Americans have on their phones. We know from whistleblowers that that data goes to the Chinese Communist Party. We know from whistleblowers that that data has been used by the Chinese Communist Party to arrest people, to kidnap them, maybe to kill them, people who have never been heard of since they were picked up by the CCP. And we know that the Chinese government, the tyrannical regime led by Xi Jinping, that they have as one of their major goals to use propaganda and to use surveillance to try to reshape the world with their values rather than American values. And so we drastically underestimate how much of this is already being done. Americans are a little cavalier about our privacy. We just assume that everybody's got everything anyway. And so what do we care if X or Facebook have more information? The threat posed by TikTok is many, many, many times more grave than is posed by other social media platforms. And by the way, we would never let the Soviets, during the height of the Cold War, go purchase a major American television stations and radio stations and newspapers, regardless of what the content was on those platforms. We would never let the Soviets control that degree of the American public square. And yet here we are letting the Chinese Communist Party do just that.
I heard Democratic Congressman Richie Torres say the same thing a couple weeks ago, that you wouldn't let, you know, the USSR own ABC or CNN or CBS or whatever at the height of the Cold War. You're saying the same thing. Are we at the height of something with China?
I think things could get considerably worse with China, but they don't have to. I mean, none of us should desire a hot war with China. And honestly, none of us should seek a cold war. Maybe we're already there, but things could get a lot worse. And I think we want to, while we are doing everything we can appropriately to make our country less reliant on China, we also don't want this to be a call for us to pull into ourselves. You don't strengthen your supply chains by putting all of your eggs in one basket, the domestic basket. You strengthen your supply chains by diversifying them. And so this is an opportunity for us to draw closer to the global South. I mean, let's nearshore, let's onshore, let's friendshore. Let's work with those people who share our values to make them and us richer and safer. And we should absolutely be working to do that. And I think those efforts will make us safer and hopefully lead toward a China that changes its behavior rather than heads in an even worse direction.
Okay, speaking of that, this is my final question for you. I want your thoughts. An American CEO who says he met with Xi Jinping at the China Development Forum told a CNBC reporter that she met with him and other business executives for an hour and a half. And she told them, among other things, they know how to fix the problems with their own economy, that it's not right for the U.S. to try to constrain China's economy, specifically on semiconductor production, and that Taiwan is a red line that China doesn't interfere with other countries' borders, so other countries shouldn't interfere with theirs. What do you make of that?
That's all balderdash. I mean, almost every line of that, it is hard to believe. And if there are American CEOs that are taking Xi Jinping's word for it, they are too naive to have their jobs. I mean, the reality is China does meddle in our border. We know that China has spent obscene amounts of money in cyber attacks on our border technology, on our infrastructure. They have spent obscene amounts of money trying to meddle in American elections. Those recent elections have so often been about border security. We know that China meddles absolutely nonstop in the elections of dozens of countries. And in fact, their foreign relations with many countries, including the United Kingdom, have been seriously scarred because of that meddling. And China doesn't know how to fix the problem with their own economy. That's the problem with the tyrannical regime. I get it. There are problems with capitalism, but it is still the very best system because it doesn't anoint one king or one dictator as the central planner. It says that all of us are smarter than any of us. People get to make their own decisions about what to invest in, how many widgets we need, and how many mouse traps. China's economy is going to continue to be in a bad spot for a while because Xi Jinping is nowhere near as smart as the universe of American entrepreneurs. That central planning is not going to lead well. And I would just close by saying this. For too long, American businesses have been drawn into China because of greed. And of course, greed can be a good thing, but it can also be a blindfold over the eyes of thoughtful and wise decision making. American companies who are making themselves too reliant on Chinese markets, Chinese workers, or Chinese government are going to, over the long haul, pay a very serious price for it because China is a terrible partner.
Congressman Dusty Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That will do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington podcast. Tomorrow, it's not just about the top of the ticket in November. The United States Senate is up for grabs. The director of the Fox News Decision Desk, Arnon Mishkin, looks at the toss-up states that will determine control of the upper chamber. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.